Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to Garden Better. I'm Adam Woodhams, and with me is Jenny Dillon.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
I'm fantastic, Jen. Hey, look, this episode, we've got some great stuff coming up. We are going to try and decode that whole mystery of plant names. You know, all those confusing old MacDonald EIOs and everything.
Oh, I don't know. It kind of makes us a secret society, don't you think?
It's a bit like that. It's like a secret handshake, isn't it? Then we're going to have a bit of a look at what's often called bush tucker. I'm going to have a chat with an absolutely fascinating bloke, Bruce Pascoe, the multi-award-winning author of the book Dark Emu.
I'm so looking forward to listening in on that.
And, of course, at the end of the show, who do we have, Jen?
Milton.
Yay!
Milton Black. Yes.
Now, Jen.
Yes.
Using plant names.
I do it all the time.
No, but it's fraught with problems, isn't it? Often we use common names. And I will say, though, Australia is recognised as being a country where we do, in common usage, use a lot of genuine botanical names.
We do use
a lot of proper names, yeah, when we're talking about plants, and not just us orticultural types, mm-hmm, but just in general nursery, and a lot of people know an agapanthus as an agapanthus. They don't know it as the other common names like
the Nile lily.
Lily of the Nile or Nile lily. If you said that in a lot of nurseries, people would look at you quite blankly.
But you know what? It's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
I'm going to put my feminist hat on here. We call casuarinas casuarinas, because in the past they used to call them she-oaks.
That's right.
And the reason for that was when the settlers first came out here from Europe, they chopped it down. They said, hey, that's not bad. Kind of looks like a yolk. Not as good as, though.
Not as good as a he-oak, so it's a she-oak.
Yeah, yes, so anyway, no more she-oaks, they're all casuarinas.
Well, and the other point is, too, that those common names can be different from state to states. So if you talk about a blue gum in New South Wales, it'll be a different tree to Victoria's blue gum or Tasmania's blue gum. So you can get very confusing. And reality is, with this technical naming, you can literally go anywhere in the world and you can have a conversation with somebody about plants and discuss a plant and not speak the language of that person, because you share a common language through the language
global.
Of plants. Yeah. And it's technically called botanical nomenclature. That's the name of it. And it adheres to a process of a taxonomy or classification. That's the way the whole process works. Now, just to explain a little bit about how that is all put together, there is a structure to it, and the very long full names have seven main sections. So they have a kingdom. And in the case of plants, it's plantae, then division, class, order, family, and the two that most concern us gardeners is genus and species. They're the ones that we talk about. And then you get those little subdivisions off there, such as cultivars and varieties and things.
Yeah.
So, for instance, you might get a eucalypt, a flowering gum, and that would be Corymbia. That's the genus. And then Physifolia would be the species. And then Wildfire might be the cultivar. So that's the way it runs. And you might just get that referred to as Corymbia Wildfire.
But what also is really good about it is pronunciation is totally irrelevant.
Yes.
You pronounce it any way you like, because I would say Ficifolia.
Yes. Well, and so
because it's a made up language.
This is the point we need to look at too, is that a lot of this is a made up language. And I should also point out too, there are three main kingdoms, as I mentioned before, and they are animal, mineral, and vegetable. And remember the old question
and
the guessing game?
Yes.
Is it animal, mineral? That's where it comes from, is these kingdoms. But the whole process was created of binomial nomenclature, was developed by a Swedish scientist called Carl Linnaeus in the 18th century. So he basically created this whole way of pulling all of these names together. And the number of bits in that language, that botanic language, is what makes it quite interesting. I joked about the old MacDonald reference before, and it's a bit like that. It's like EIEIOs all over the place.
All over the place.
Sometimes in very random ways. And you'd be forgiven for thinking it's Latin or that it's Greek, and it's not. It's actually a little bit of everything.
It draws from so many different places.
It's Latinized. It's English basically Latinized, and then it's a mix of ancient Greek. And, yes, there are made-up words in there too, mm-hmm. which is what's kind of cool about it, because you can just come up with all funky and interesting names.
What you can do, which I find so fascinating about these names, is that you can trace the origin of the plants. So if something is called a japonica, you know it comes from Japan.
Mm, and Asiaticum might be from the Asian region.
Or
and,
Cantoniensis comes yeah. from Canton in China.
Yeah, yeah, so you do get those definite naming things. And sometimes they are people's names too. Like, for instance, the whole group of plants, the Banksias,
yeah.
were named in honour of Sir Joseph Banks, the famous botanist that explored with James Cook. Or the Grevillea, Robin Gordon was after a breeder of plants. But yes, that's exactly right. As you said, you can tell a bit about the region of a plant. So not just that, you can tell something about the characteristics of a plant. So Jasminoides means that it's jasmine-like.
Mm-hmm.
Giganteum.
Huge.
Yep, no points for guessing what that one means. Oh, and that thanks. Might be in reference to the flower or to the foliage. Alba means white. Yeah. Yep. Ficifolia or ficifolia, however you like to pronounce it, means like a fig leaf is the general reference to it. Glabra means smooth. Longiflora.
Long flowers.
And longifolia.
Long leaves.
Absolutely. And this is one that I really like because you run across this a lot with herbs. Officinalis. So if you see officinalis in a name, it means that it has some sort of herbal use. So that might be medicinal or culinary. Mm. So rosemary officinalis.
I was just thinking of that, yeah.
But it's not all totally sensible. And particularly with the modern botanists, they seem to have done some very interesting things with names. So there's actually a group of recently discovered or recently split off from another division of little aquatic ferns, I think they are, and they're all been named Gaga. Is their family name, their genus.
Yeah.
And then you've got species like Germanotta, which is named after Stefani Germanotta, which is
Lady Gaga, my favourite singer. I think she's great.
And then there's Gaga Monstra Parvera, which is named after her.
Little monsters.
Little monsters, absolutely. But my favourite one that I ran across when I was doing a little bit of advanced reading was a fungus recently discovered called Spongiforma Squarepantsii.
No.
Yes, what? It's named after SpongeBob SquarePants. It's true. It is out there and it's a little fungus called Spongiforma Squarepantsii.
Well, that says something about that creature. It's a fungus.
Well, you have to say, though, isn't it nice to know that even these people that are often perceived as very nerdy types do have a sense of humour and they do get a good pop culture reference?
Well, that's true, but...
So next time you are looking at those confusing plant labels, just remember that they're not actually all that confusing in many respects. There can be some very good information in there.
Yes.
Jen, when we think about bush taka, it's a pretty narrow range of plants, isn't it?
Sadly.
There's not a lot that comes to mind. And most of the plants offered, they really, look, I love them, but they do tend to be more of a novelty value than a staple, you know, something really substantial you'd be growing. But let's have a look a little bit at what constitutes bush taka and a few of these different plants that people might want to give a try in the home garden. So the colonial interpretation of our First Nations people was nomadic hunter-gatherers. What do you reckon, true or false?
No.
We were having a bit of a chat about this off mic, weren't we? About how there's just some things that they used as food sources that don't align with that whole concept of
there was serious food production going on within the communities, and that is not a hunter gatherer lifestyle. Yeah.
Well, there was a couple that we talked about. Like I used the example of the native cycad, the burrowing, it's most often called, and that seed. Can be very nutritious, but to get the food out of that seed, there's some great examples of early settlers eating one of these seeds and becoming terribly ill afterwards because they do look quite edible. Mm-hmm. But the Aboriginal people knew that to be able to use them, they would convert them to flour, I think. But basically you had to slice them extremely thin. They had to be left in running water for quite an extended period of time to leach all the toxins out of them. Then they had to be dried, and then they'd be turned into the type of product they'd use as food. And now if you're talking nomadic and hunter-gatherer, that doesn't fit, does it? Because that implies that you're in a place for a period of time, you're there for long enough to know what's cropping.
And if you're making flour, you're cooking.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another point. That's not, you know, picking nuts and berries as you wander through the woods. That's a wee bit more substantial than that. So I think the simple fact is the range of foods extended well beyond berries and, you know, kangaroos, a bit of fish and some witchetty grubs. There was a much bigger range of food out there. And there are a couple of great books you can read on this topic. There's Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe, and we're going to be talking with Bruce in a little while. And The Biggest Estate on Earth by Bill Gammage. That's another great one that looks at how the land was so managed and controlled by our First Nations people. But let's get back to the stuff that we can actually eat and grow at home easily that's not too difficult. One of my absolute faves is lemon myrtle.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like lemon myrtle, Backhousia citriodora?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's wonderful. We had one in our last garden, and it had been beautifully shaped when I bought it. So it had actually been pruned into a conical shape. So
I was wondering how you'd prune that.
Yeah, yeah. And it took to pruning really well, and I kept it pruned in the time that we had that garden, because it's in that family of plants that do tolerate pruning quite well. And it smells beautiful. Mm. This incredibly zingy citrus. Yeah, really, really strong. And it's wonderful to use in so many ways. You know, for instance, if you were baking fish, you can put a few leaves in with the fish and it just infuses it with this really rich, zingy lemon flavor. One of my favorites is in tea. So if you're having a cup of green tea, you just crunch up a leaf of the lemon myrtle and drop that in when you're pouring the hot water in, and it adds a beautiful lemon tang to the tea. So that's one of my favorites. Now, you and I both, I know, love the native finger limes.
Yep. They're just fantastic what you can do with this. And they just are such a surprise. You know, these little fat fruit that are dark and ugly, they look like fat fingers. Yeah. They really do. And then you open it up and it's just this cascade of glistening pearls coming out.
It is. It's like citrus gorgeous. Citrus caviar is the only way to describe it. It's just incredible stuff. And they do literally burst in your mouth like caviar, except with citrus flavors. And so colorful. The fruit is just incredible. But warning there, they're rather thorny little things, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Great to put under an open window. If you like to have your windows open, plant one there. You'll hear the burglar.
Yeah, if anyone tries to get in the window, you will know about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here's one that I think often gets forgotten about as being a native, but the macadamia.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's one of our best natives. And the funny thing is that it was picked up overseas and grown as a crop before we got smart enough to start growing it ourselves.
And so, aren't they just wonderful?
Yeah, there's enormous amounts grown in places like Hawaii.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a wonderful thing. And it is actually quite a beautiful tree too. When it's in flower, it has big long panicles of flowers. They look quite lovely.
And it's a very slender tree too.
Mm, yeah, they're quite naturally thin, so they have a good narrow shape. So if you had a
lovely mottled bark as well.
Yeah, well, if you had a medium-sized backyard, they're a great one to sort of put up towards the back corner. So say, for instance, you wanted to screen out afternoon sun or something, they'd be perfect for that because they'd like that sunny condition. And the nuts are just fantastic. Mm. They're great fun to watch people trying to crack open.
Yes.
And one that a lot of people don't know about, which I really actually quite like, is often called warrigal greens. And this is grown in New Zealand as well because it's one of those plants that's shared across regions. It is absolutely lovely.
It's the best
leafy green
pesto you could make with pine nuts.
Mm.
Much better than basil.
Yeah, you normally throw lots of basil into a pesto.
If you just mix up your warrigal greens, I mean, it's like a spinach.
Yeah.
And it just grows. We can see all over the coastal areas of the East Coast.
In very, very harsh conditions. It's actually fantastic for growing underneath things like citrus because it likes similar sort of conditions. Yeah. So you can use it as a living mulch, and it's that type of plant that forms a great living mulch. If you're going to eat it, though, it is one of those plants that does require a little bit of treatment. So you don't want to eat it completely raw. It does need to be processed in one way or another. So you just blanch the leaves because they have a high oxalic acid content.
Yes.
So they can be a little bit prickly in the mouth if you don't actually do something with them first. But I reckon that's a fantastic
one. It should be a must-have in every garden.
Use it for many, many things in the kitchen. But lily pillies, there's another one too. We forget about the fact that the fruit on them, apart from being colourful, is very edible.
The birds certainly know about it.
Birds do know about it. And doesn't your car know about it when the birds have been knowing about it? But you can make jams and things from it too, or you can just eat them straight off the bush. And bottle brush, this is a great one to try with the kids, that you can actually just dip bottle brush flowers into a glass of water and it's instant bush cordial. Because all the nectar comes out of the bottle brush. So that's a great fun one. But I think an interesting one to remember too is that years ago I was working with a whole lot of trainees and we did a workshop on various bush tucker and Aboriginal foods, and they were turning their noses up. It was a whole heap of teenagers and they turned their noses up at many of the things we were tasting. And as I pointed out to them at that time, there's a difference between edible and enjoyable, that just because something isn't toxic, it doesn't mean it's going to taste absolutely brilliant. So some of these things that may have been eaten for food may have actually just been almost like a survival snack as opposed to something you're eating because you want it to be of a, you know, a great value as a food. So,
yeah. It's not quite like having a Mars bar on top of it.
No, exactly. It's like, you know, Diane Elliott berries are often described as being quite edible as bush tucker. And I've tasted some and they're not very nice. But I am sure if you were in need of something, some sustenance, they would get you through.
That would get you through.
So have a look in your local nursery, because I have noticed there is a lot more good bush tucker starting to appear with labels like native food and stuff like that.
It's getting stronger and stronger all the time.
It is getting better all the time.
There's a lot of excitement in the industry there.
Yeah, so check it out. You might be surprised about what you can grow at your place.
Yes.
Now, I mentioned the fantastic multi-award-winning book Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe, and we are fortunate enough to have Bruce on the line for a chat. Bruce, welcome, mate.
Lovely to be with you.
Now, look, being a horticulturalist myself, and I'm a bit of an amateur history nerd, I've always believed I had a pretty good handle on how our Aboriginals, our First Nations people, how they used the land. But, Bruce, I have to say, I read Dark Emu, and it just, as I said to you in the first email I sent you, it just totally recalibrated my compass. Now, can you give folks a quick outline of what you explore in the book?
It began with another book I'd written called Convincing Ground, which was about contact wars. And after that came out, I received a lot of information from people about other aspects of Aboriginal life. And even in the research for Convincing Ground, I was coming up with information which just didn't gel with the idea of Australian Aboriginal people being wanderers and hunters and gatherers. And the more I began to explore it, the more obvious it became that what we'd been told about Aboriginal Australia was pretty much completely wrong. And maybe that had been the self-serving nature of colonialism. Maybe it was other reasons that I can't understand. But anyway, that was the fact of it. And, you know, we had to re-examine the history. Otherwise, we were going to be living a bit of a fairy tale.
It explodes the hunter-gatherer myth and really explores the fact that the Aboriginal peoples were, in fact, pretty smart agriculturalists. They were making use of the land in broadacre ways, and they were doing everything that as a horticulturalist I would consider as being, you know, smart land use and smart growing. And they were basically breeding seeds for particular uses. They were selecting them for their best characteristics. So, you know, they were effectively hybridizing plants to get the best varieties to be grown as cultivars. And what we're talking about is broadacre grains and some wonderful yams that you talk about. So this wasn't just a wandering through the bush picking nuts and berries, as is, oft portrayed in the history books, is it?
No, and if people had been wandering through the bush picking berries, there would have been no villages and houses, no sophisticated fish traps and things like that. So as soon as you begin to look at it, you realise that there was a much more complex economy going on than we'd been led to believe.
Just fish traps alone, to me, have always stood out as being, you know, I've always saw those as an anomaly, because that the trouble that you go to create a large fish trap implies a degree of permanence. You know, that's not something that a wandering people tend to do. And look, we've been chatting earlier in the show about the contemporary perception of bush tucker, and reality is that a lot of the way we approach bush tucker is almost as novelty value food. You know, it's a berry here, or a leaf you can use as a herb here or there. You know, that there's nothing really substantial in there. And do you think that in some respects this is a perpetuation of that, you know, colonialism, I really think is the only way you can describe it, that, you know, we are still stuck in that mentality of assuming that was the only sort of thing that was done?
I think that's about right. I think that we seem to be stuck in that view of Australian Aboriginal people, which was perpetuated in order to validate the invasion of the country and being a Christian country and supposedly moral, the idea was that there had to be a reason for it, and that reason that was perpetrated was that Aboriginal people were just wandering around, they weren't using the soil. If that had been 80% the case, then you could imagine people accepting it fairly readily. But early entrants into country saw that wasn't the case straight away, that there were crops, there were harvests, there were stooks of grain, there were vessels holding a ton of grain, and all of those things made people aware that Aboriginal people had an agricultural economy. Well, and subsequent generations, of course, it suited their purposes too, because they were on the land. And even when they found evidence to the contrary, they weren't going to give up their land.
No, and this is what I found most interesting, that your book isn't based on any sort of theoretical assumptions. Basically, the foundation of much of what you discuss in the book is, in fact, the records of those first settlers, the first white fellas onto that territory, onto the country. Their records are just astounding. They're talking about, you know, seeing acres and acres of rolling paddocks filled with grain and piles of grain ready for threshing. And then in the same sentence, they'll talk about, you know, the primitive black fellas that obviously must have learnt this from somewhere else. You know, there's virtually a degree of denial as to the reality of the situation they were staring at when they encounter a ton of processed flour and don't think that maybe this is actually quite an amazing thing.
It's really, really hard to understand that there weren't some people around, you know, just intrigued by this and wanting to explore it and revel in the idea of this society. But colonialism doesn't allow for that, unfortunately. So that was the situation we were in. It happened all over the world, wherever Europeans went. But to ignore it now doesn't say much for our inclusiveness.
No, I think that's a point that there's, you know, I think we do need to reach a point of maturity and get into some serious truth telling on these sort of issues. It's an interesting thing I found when I've often looked back and looked at many of the historic paintings of the early days of the colony, you would get pictures of these beautiful pieces of what looked for all the world like English countryside, you know, with the sparsely separated trees that you could literally drive a carriage through in between. I'll be honest, I'd always just assumed that was, you know, the artists were pining for home, you know, that they were just wanting it to look European, to attract more settlers out here and all that sort of thing. But that is the reality of what they were seeing, isn't it? That this land was being so carefully managed that you didn't have the typical bush that we see today with that dense underscrub underneath a tree canopy. That simply did not exist, because the land was being very, very extensively, very carefully, meticulously managed with techniques that were being handed down from generation to generation that was effectively all just blown out of the water as soon as everybody was dispossessed.
Bill Gammage wrote an interesting book. That goes a long way to explaining the situation of what the country looked like. And in many ways, our current debates about drought and bushfire should be viewed through that lens, that Aboriginal people had manicured the land in their management systems and they were very safe, fire safe, and yet still incredibly productive. And as a farming community, I think we're desperate for solutions but reluctant to credit Aboriginal people with the answer.
This is something interesting you discuss in your book, is that there was such a wide number of grains, a number of them being gluten-free, which obviously is a very important market today. There was a native rice that was relatively widely grown. So there's these crops are all there that are perhaps it could be argued are much more suitable to our climate and our environment and would require less harm and less damage to our water sources and to soils, et cetera.
Yeah, there's sorghums and there's millets, flowers made out of water lily seed, nardoo, which grows in those ephemeral lakes in central Australia. We could be growing grain over a much wider area than we're currently growing it. And even though the yields per acre are going to be less than irrigated crops and annual crops, but if we're growing perennials that don't need any water, we're going to sequester carbon with our crops. We're also going to leave water in the river so we don't have fish dying. And all farmers and all towns will have better access to water. Because at the moment we're devoting incredible percentages of Australian water to crops like rice and cotton.
And simply it's not sustainable. That's what it comes down to. Now, look, I had an interesting chat with an older bloke not too long ago, and it was one that I'm sure you will have encountered yourself more than your fair share of times. And this guy had an agricultural background. And he swore black and blue that there could not have been any prior agriculture before white settlement. And his main argument was that, you know, there's no evidence and they didn't have metal tools and they didn't have harnessed animals. Now, what would you say to that sort of situation? What was curious was this guy actually got angry with me. You know, he just did not want to hear about the possibility.
Yep. We didn't have metal tools and we didn't have harnessed animals. Kangaroos are particularly difficult in harness. And talk about the stump jump plough, you'd be all over the joint. Aboriginal people did it differently. The farming looked incredibly different because it was labour intensive. The whole community took part in the preparation and the harvest. Aboriginal people were hardworking, built water retention areas, dams, irrigated some crops, diverted water to make sure that their grains of field got one good watering a year. That's all they needed. It was complex, and it didn't look like European farming because there's no private ownership, so there's no fences. And Aboriginal people were able to farm without the fence because their protein resources were kangaroos. So they didn't need to fence them in. In fact, you can't. But you could take advantage of those kangaroos and the emus by drafting them. And when we look at the landscape today, we can see areas. Most have been destroyed by farming applications. But in some places, you actually see where Aboriginal people had built walls to guide kangaroos into killing areas. Michael Archer says that Australian farmers are already grazing kangaroos. Why aren't we using them? Every farm in this district grows kangaroos, and yet we concentrate on beef.
Yeah.
We could be killing kangaroos easily. And Archer's done investigations into the killing of kangaroos and found that after intensive culling of kangaroos for meat, the population actually went up.
Yes.
I don't understand that, but it's a science-based research.
And it's the ultimate free-range meat.
Yeah. And it's not full of drenches. And the feet are soft. This is the really important thing for farmers. I am getting a lot of mail from farmers who are understanding that their reading of history shows them that our soils are highly compacted now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to do with vehicle use and hard-hoofed animals in particular, and in particular, sheep. And so farmers are beginning to think about the stock they carry. I think if we turn to those soft-footed animals, we'd be looking after our country a lot better.
Well, and this is the thing, you know, the land and the animals that live on it evolve in unison, don't they? And if you look at the fossil records, Australia never had hard-hoofed animals. Everything was always traditionally soft-footed animals of one sort or another. So
Now,
one thing I found very interesting was that you point out in the book too that there's evidence of flour grinding, seed grinding and flour making going back 30,000 years, which is in fact putting the Australian Aboriginals as being bakers around 15,000 years before the Egyptians were, which has always been the traditional benchmark for the beginning of baking. Now that's absolutely astounding stuff.
It's ancient. And a discovery last year at Mujibibi brought up a new grinding dish which was examined, and it was found that it had been used to grind grain into flour 65,000 years ago.
Wow, that is just
This is an incredible moment in human history. We should be interested in it, we should be proud of it, and we should use it.
I find it astounding as a horticulturalist who has a strong interest in sustainability that, you know, we're talking broadacre native food crops that require less water, less cultivation, they're less damaging to the soil. They don't require the pesticides, the herbicides, the fertilizers. It is exactly the sort of thing that as a smart society we should be looking towards, yet there still seems to be, you know, some sort of reluctance there, particularly when we're staring down the barrel of everything that's going on with our changing climate. You know, it seems to me just crazy. People need to be getting a better handle on this. And as I said, Dark Emu for me was quite an eye-opener. And I personally believe it should be on the curriculum of every school kid in the country. And that being a point, you have recently released a version of the book for younger readers, haven't you?
Yeah, Young Dark Emu has been designed to bring that information to younger readers, and it has been going really well. The sustainability is a really interesting question, and Charles Massey also had an interesting book come out last year called The Cry of the Reed Wall, a beautifully titled book about sustainable farming. So Bill Gammage, Charles and myself, we go around to a lot of conferences and talk with sustainable farmers, with permaculturalists and people like that. It's really interesting to hear people who have tried these methods. Some farmers who are working full-time on their farms have told me that by using those methods, perennial grains and things like that, they are making as much money as they did before, perhaps a bit more, but because they're not relying on chemicals, they are and ploughing, their costs are down.
That's
one farmer told me that he hadn't made a profit in 20 years until last year.
Wow.
And that was because he'd cut out his chemical load. There's a real lesson in that.
Yeah, well, I think it's an area that I believe a lot more people need to approach with a much more open mind, Bruce, and it's some of our leaders need to be taking a closer look at this stuff, because it is very, very worthy of learning from some peoples that know a heck of a lot more about the land than any of us do. So, Bruce Pascoe, thank you very much for joining us. There's a lot of food for thought in there. Seems to me that we are way past time for some serious truth-telling on this topic and, you know, the reality of our Aboriginal agriculture. And if you'd like to learn more about Bruce's multi-award-winning book, Chase Up Dark Emu, it is a fantastic read, and I've just managed to grab a recent reissue of it myself, which has some extra notes added in there. So even worth more reading on a third approach. So, Bruce, thank you very much for your time.
Good on you. Thanks very much. It was lovely to talk to you.
Gardening by the Moon with Milton Black.
Hi, Milton. How are things going?
Oh, I've been out in that garden because February is such a good month for getting into that garden, Jen. And I suppose you've been the same too, have you? You've been pretty busy.
Yep, I certainly have. Really been enjoying myself.
Well, of course, you know, this month of February now is such a good month for removing all those laterals from those steak tomatoes and, you know, sort of stop at 5 or 6 trusses of fruit and things like this. But overhead watering, if you're putting in overhead water, you probably need a little bit because this February has been still hot.
Mm.
And keep that moisture nice and nice around your plants in the garden. Look, I think white fly control is something that some people around the country may have to watch out for too, because these small winged insects seem to survive, but it does matter over the winter periods and that they hibernate and then they come out and buzz into that garden. So just watch around the countryside with that white fly and you have to control it. Now, lawns also, of course, the spring and sort of summer rains are very unfrequent at this time of the year because of the droughts that we've been having. But fortunately, we've had a bit of rain, so that's not too bad. But I think we'll find that lawns do need a little bit of looking after over this this month of February as well. So
yeah, they do.
As from virtually today, Monday the 3rd, the moon's in Gemini, and it will stay in Gemini till Wednesday the 5th. Now, this is not a good time for planting under any circumstances because it's a fertile sign. So I would suggest if it needs watering, if it is real dry and you need watering, that's a good time to do it. Clean up around the garden, just a little minor maintenance, no fertilizing, but just a little bit of cleaning up during that cycle. But on Thursday, the moon actually enters into the very fertile sign of Cancer at 5 o'clock in the morning. So Thursday, Friday is an excellent time for the above ground crops in the garden. And you can still put your lettuces, your peas, and don't forget your cauliflower and hickory and things like this, and a bit of eggplant, celery, all those sort of things, capsicums, cabbage. They can be all planted over this particular period as well. And the old pumpkins too, they can still be grown at this stage. And also you can pick those pumpkins that you've put in before too. They should be starting to look pretty healthy at this stage as well. So that's a good cycle for actually planting above ground crops on Thursday, Friday. The moon enters on the 8th. Saturday the 8th into Leo, and we've got a full moon in Leo on the 9th. So you can have the weekend off. Just enjoy yourself. And you can do that right through those 2 days, the week after that, Monday, right through to the last quarter on the 16th. Now, that's a full week there. The moon in Virgo on the 10th is a no planting time, but the 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th, and 15th, excellent, excellent days for anything that grows below the ground. So your onions, your radishes, potatoes still, turnips, any swedes, all those sort of things. And up until the 15th, the 16th is the last quarter of the moon, so you can have the day off there, planting at all. And just could perhaps put a little bit of fertilizer for those that need to on the 16th. But I'd be more inclined to just water. But I think you'll find that if you follow that rule, you'll have a good sort of autumn coming up garden here.
Fantastic.
Now, incidentally, you know, I love blondes. I really do. My wife's a blonde, of course, but I love blondes. A lot of people give blondes a bit of a hard go, but I think that they're pretty good in the garden too. But I'll tell you what, I just happened to be in Sydney this particular day, and these two blondes were sitting on the bench seat, and I overheard one of the blondes say to the other, "What do you think is the farthest away, Brisbane or the moon?" And the other blonde turned to her and says, "Hello, you can't see Brisbane."
Hello.
I'll see you next week.
Take care. Bye.
Well, that was another great episode, Jen. I just want to rush out into the garden myself.
Oh, I'm not stopping you. Off you go. Adam, where can people find you?
They can find me in the garden, or they can look me up on YouTube. Just search Adam Woodhams and I'll pop up there, no problem at all, or on Instagram, of course.
And if you want more garden inspiration before the next episode, you can pick up the latest copy of Better Homes and Gardens magazine at selected supermarkets and news agencies.
So we'll see you next time, Jen.
You bet.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. and UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.